So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. September in Wisconsin is far from predictable, and this year we've had some pretty much picture-perfect fall weather around the state. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, maybe we'll find out a little bit more about when we talk with John Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, great to see you back.
Good to see you, Larry.
Steve Ackerman, the other half of our team, is hacking and coughing.
Yeah,
and
he's Steve Ackerman today. He's got a bad cough. Can't get rid of it. Yeah.
So we didn't want him.
Yeah.
Most of the time we want Steve, but we didn't want him today. So he's gonna hang home, and maybe he's listening in. If you are, Steve, get better soon. You may have a question for John about weather or about climate. We certainly talk about both. And I hope you'll join in with those questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. And John, well, we have had pretty much picture-perfect fall weather for the last few weeks, as some people would define it, I think.
I think it's been even better than that. I mean, we've had a way above normal September for temperature, and yet not uncomfortably so. So, you know, that's the nature of September. The average high in the middle of the month is somewhere around 70. So if you get into 77 or 78 on a day, it feels great, and it hasn't been too humid most of the time.
Yeah.
Absolutely spectacular month. I think it's my favorite month of the year around here.
Yeah, it's really, really, really nice. What brings on about, why do we have those great conditions?
Well, part of it, I think, is a recession of really high water vapor contents. It really starts to disappear in late August, the really horrible humidity. Maybe Labor Day weekend, you occasionally get a really humid weekend. But once that goes away, you can take a temperature that's 78 or 82 degrees without too much complaint. Whereas in August, if it's 82 with a dew point of 70, it feels miserable, and everybody gets tired of it. So I think that's part of it. And then the nights are, of course, longer and usually a little cooler, and so you can sleep more comfortably at night, and you can enjoy a nice warm day. Just nothing like it. Month of September is great around here.
And October is pretty good, too. I like
October. Most of October is pretty good, too, is right. We usually have our first measurable snow sometime in October, meaning a tenth of an inch or more. But that's hit or miss. Some years you don't get it, and other years you get it. But never too much of it if it happens in a year. And sometimes Halloween's even 80 degrees. It's rare, but it happens.
I was trying to remember the last few years has been actually pretty warm,
I think so too.
Around Halloween. Leslie in Tomahawk has a question for you.
Hi.
Hi, Leslie. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. My question is, we keep hearing and reading a lot that it's going to be an El Nino year.
Mm.
And we're just wondering about that. We had some maybe travel plans for different parts of the country and are thinking, well, maybe this isn't the best time to go this year and maybe just stay put. So just, I guess, your thoughts on how that might pan out or any information on it.
Sure. It does seem to be developing into perhaps the strongest El Nino on record. It's going to be among the top five.
Right.
That could be the case. Now, that's a forecast. That's not a statement of what's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
But our ability to forecast these features a month or two in advance, sometimes months more than that in advance, has gotten demonstrably better in the last 10 years. And so we have an already pretty strong signal down in the equatorial Pacific surface temperature. And the forecast is for it to challenge the top three or four El Nino events of all time. What that means for us in the Great Lakes states is it usually means a warmer and not any wetter winter. But, of course, the form of the precipitation in such a winter is vastly different. I think that we have less snow and more rain in a really wound up El Nino year. In Southern California, across the Big Bend area of Texas, all the way to the Gulf Coast of Florida, that's a place, that whole stretch gets wetter than normal. So it's demonstrably more precipitation for those places than a usual winter if, you know, the El Nino develops and things go the way that it often does go with an El Nino. Other parts of the country, Pacific Northwest, doesn't have a particularly strong signal one way or the other. New England, the same thing. You can have pretty much normal conditions or highly variable around normal. It's not strongly controlled by the El Nino. The Great Lakes states tend to have some control, even stronger control of the weather down over the southern tier of states, all the way from the west to the east coast.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And, well, we're at, let's stay on the phones. Go to Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hey, my name is Mike Hawk. I was just wondering, what the forecast for actually Halloween this year is expected to be.
Ah.
Yeah, that's a scary topic. We don't like to jump that far in advance. That's 5 weeks from today or something close to that, isn't it? So that's something we can't really make a forecast at 5 weeks out. I would say this, though, that in the 5 weeks between now and Halloween, we're likely to see a continuation of pretty nice weather that we've had so far. I don't expect any significant cold snaps. I don't expect, especially in the next 2 weeks, I don't expect that we'll probably not have any major snow event between now and Halloween in the southern part of the state, but that's about all I can say. And what I'm doing is spouting climatology. So we can't really make a forecast at 5 weeks out, unfortunately.
What's the, and we've talked about this in the past, we can go with pretty darn good accuracy out, what, how many days?
I'd say seven now, almost any time of the year. The summertime, it's less confident because you can get a thunderstorm that grows and dies within 5 hours, and so that's not going to show up in a seven-day forecast particularly well. As you get into the cold season, the forecast accuracy increases, actually, for this kind of forecast, painting the complexion of the day in a reasonable way. I think you can do that out to about 10 days in many instances in the wintertime.
Excellent.
So that's pretty good.
Yeah, Mike, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Raleigh in Oak Creek, your turn. Hi, Raleigh.
Hi. Thanks, Steve, for coming on again. Again, my question is regarding El Nino. And whether the Great Lakes collectively can produce their own El Nino effect, their pretty big bodies of water. And I wonder if there's any research into that and what his thoughts are.
John Martin, what do you think?
Yeah, no, there's no way that the lakes, big as they are, can have the influence that an El Nino has, because you're talking about an enormous square area of the Pacific Ocean at the equator. And so for a given degree of latitude and longitude at the equator, you got a gigantic amount of area, and much bigger than we have up here. And that warm water at the equator also has the advantage of, when it goes up in thunderstorm clouds, it has a lot of momentum because the equator is spinning around the Earth's axis at a much greater speed than it is at 43 degrees north where we are. So there's a lot more angular momentum in the air that's rising through those thunderstorms, and that has big impacts on the global circulation by affecting the jet stream, particularly the subtropical jet. And the Great Lakes don't have anywhere near the sort of influence to be able to do that. That being said, the lakes definitely have a local warming effect in the wintertime and a local cooling effect in the summertime. And that can have substantial impacts on local precipitation type in the winter and maybe the amounts of snow or rain that you get. But it really can't have the global impact or even the large regional impact that something like the El Nino has.
But if you're in Milwaukee, for example, and you know it's cooler along the lake,
no doubt about it.
In the summertime,
that's because of the lake. Yep, it has those local effects that are rock solid. They'll never go away.
Yep, there we go. Thanks, Raleigh.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in too. The number to call 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Open lines will get you on pretty quickly here with your weather or climate question. We had an email question from Carl, who listens to us in Mexico and wonders, how is it possible that the Midwest is 10 degrees warmer than it is here in Mexico?
Ah, that's really interesting. Depends on where you are. I don't know exactly where in Mexico. If you're at elevation, then that can be the whole story right there.
Yeah.
If you're at 8,000 feet or something, you're going to be cooler than we are down here at sea level, enjoying a relatively warm September. So that might be the whole story. I don't know if that is. As far as I know, there's no particular cold air mass that's kind of made its way southward along the west coast of North America that would make it colder in Mexico at sea level than it is here. So that would probably be the answer.
All right. Thanks a lot, Carl, for calling. Appreciate it. Email question from, let's see, Dawn in Madison. While on vacation in the mountains of Utah at 8,000-plus elevation, I noticed the winds would start and end suddenly. It would be calm, then they would be 30 miles per hour a minute later. Wouldn't last long, maybe an hour, then back to calm. Mm. Is this common in mountain regions.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. I bet it is. I bet it is. Now, I don't spend much time at high elevation, so I don't have a lot of experience there. But I think what's probably happening, especially in Utah, where it's a fairly dry part of the world, that you're heating up the lowest part of the atmosphere to such an extent that you can once in a while get a turbulent eddy to break through what we call the top of the boundary layer. And once that happens, you probably can drag very high momentum air that's kind of just racing across the top of that boundary until it gets exploded. And then suddenly it just comes in for a split second, huge gust of wind, because it's air that's been imported from somewhere else above you. And then once that thing has kind of gone by, that's the end of it until another one can break through. So it's most likely that that's happening on heated high terrain. You can make contact with that high momentum air more frequently at high altitude.
So how do we get these altitude? How do we get these differences? Is it
the wind speed?
Higher, yeah. Is it yeah. The higher? It's colder and.
Well, it's mostly that further north it's colder and further south it's warmer. And so that sets up a basic situation in which there is always going to be an increase in the westerly winds with increasing height. And then on top of that, at elevation, you've got a situation in which you're away from a large part of the area that you might see over over a valley or something is away from the friction layer. So the winds are a little bit stronger anyway because they're not being tugged, slowed down by friction. All that stuff gets added together and you can get these really interesting gusts.
Ted and Toma, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. How does, atmospheric conditions or whatever affect sound? There's a train I can hear off in the distance from our house. Mm-hmm. And on a colder, crisp night, it just seems so sharp when that whistle goes. And then sometimes on a hot summer day, I can just hear an echo that's three times longer than the original blast, and it has a more of a muted sound or something. I don't know. Is there a difference? I mean, does that affect the sound at all? Or what?
Yeah, it does. It definitely does, and especially the cold night. And the best ones, maybe you'll agree, Ted, if you got snow on the ground and it's a crystal clear night, you're going to really hear a train whistle no matter how far away it is because the sound is a wave, just like a light wave or a water wave. And it gets bounced off of these layers in the atmosphere that can form these stable layers. I was just talking about one, as a matter of fact. The top of the boundary layer is a stable layer. It's not a particularly strong one. Overnight, when the surface of the planet cools and the air above it doesn't cool as fast, you get a really strong stratification of the lower part of the atmosphere. That means it's hard to move the air up and down through that lower part of the atmosphere. And what a sound wave is doing is it's actually moving the air up and down. And so you're having some trouble having that wave escape to the higher part of the atmosphere and therefore reduce the sound from a distance. It bounces off that stable layer, and it can kind of propagate along and reach you with a higher volume than it otherwise would. And it's exactly the reason why in the summertime it sounds much more distant and kind of muted because there isn't as much stratification to assist in the propagation of the sound. And then in addition, the wind can get in the way and kind of move sound waves around, distort them in a significant way as well.
And thanks a lot for that call. John Martin, our guest, he'll be with us till 12:30, but let's take a look at the news, then we'll be right back. There is never a shortage of things to talk about when it comes to the weather, and today is no exception. We got a great guest for you to talk about climate and weather, John Martin. John's a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And normally Steve Ackerman along, but Steve's under the weather. He's got I hope it's not the flu.
No, I hope not either. It just sounds like a cold he got on an airplane or something, but we're all under the weather, Larry. That's one of the points of the show.
Right. My goodness me. That's a good one, John. I like that. Well, let's see what Mike and Ashland's got for us. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
All right, thanks. I was just wondering from watching my phone radar over the summer if some areas in Wisconsin got record precipitation, because here in Ashland it seems like a lot of the storm fronts broke up before they got here, but other areas are watching to get hit every time.
Yeah, I don't know if I haven't seen any statistics that suggest any particular place in the state got a record amount of precipitation, but there were places that more frequently got rain than were dry. I didn't know that was true in Ashland. It seemed to be true in Dane County a lot of the time too, that you could see things developing in northeast Iowa, and they just wouldn't be able to make it, a couple of hundred miles to Dane County and stay coherent and give us any substantial precipitation. We had a fairly dry summer as a consequence. So I don't know if any place had record sort of rains in the state. I doubt it, because it would have made news on many of the sites that I tend to look at daily, looking at weather information. So I haven't seen any evidence of that.
But there's been a lot of rain in some parts of northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And weren't there the places 2 or 3 years ago that were in the, at the end of a five-year terrible drought? So it's funny how it works out.
And good news for that area.
Yeah,
those
very
areas.
Good news.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Let's Boo and Wausau. Let's go there. Hi, thank you for calling. Arbonne.
Hi, this is Mo Westerman.
Mo. Okay, sorry. What's on your mind?
I've been hearing dang loud about the old, you know, globe warming up here. So I was wondering how this ozone stuff's gonna affect my crops here in Wausau.
Okay, ozone.
Yeah, warming and ozone are not directly related. So the ozone is largely contained in the stratosphere, and we're worried about it being depleted by chemical interruption, by some of the stuff we put into the atmosphere through industry. That's been arrested to a large degree, but the threat is still there. And what the threat would mean is that if the ozone in the stratosphere were removed or substantially reduced, then we'd have more ultraviolet radiation from the sun making it all the way to the surface of the planet, and that's not good for anybody's DNA, plant, animal, whatever. And so we don't want that. And but global warming's a slightly different, well, fairly different subject. Once in a while there's intersect between the two, but not most of the time. And the warming is a slow, gradual effect that sometimes has different regional manifestations. It won't be the same every place on Earth. And so it's hard to say how that would affect crops. If ozone really did get increased in the lower part of the atmosphere by pollution, which can happen, then you can have some trouble with human breathing and human respiration. I don't know if that translates to damaging the leaves of plants. That's a good question, which I don't know the answer to.
Oh, there we go. Mo, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, you know, Wausau area, there was kind of, what would we call that, north central Wisconsin,
yeah,
I guess would be the term for it. And likely they're going to have more growing days.
That's probably right. That's probably right. And fewer days with snow at all of the ski resorts, probably,
yeah,
as time goes on. I mean, first it would be 2 or 3 days, and sooner or later it's 5 or 10.
Yeah.
It keeps on going in the same direction.
Yeah. Mo, thanks again. Appreciate the call. Good questions. Let's go to another email from Mark in Green Bay, who asked you to please explain the two choices of radar that NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration website, uses. One's called BASE, and the other's composite.
Mm. I think, I can't say without seeing it, but composite often means that they're putting together more than one radar site and giving you a regional display of maybe the upper Midwest or maybe the whole state of Wisconsin, which is going to constitute the Green Bay, the Sullivan, as well as the La Crosse site all at once. They'll composite them together. So, and then the BASE is just looking at one reflectivity site by itself, La Crosse, Green Bay, or Sullivan. I don't know if that's what's referred to in this difference, but if it is, then that's what always leads me to want to look at the composite. I want to see something of a wider scale.
Oh, there we go. Wanda in Fond du Lac up next. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. I was. We had a long road trip, and I was looking out the window one day, and I noticed, you know, when you see, like, airplanes, and they leave their, you know, their track or, you know, the
yeah,
jet fuel or whatever.
The contrail, yeah.
You know, my question is this. Some days you see it and there, you know, tracks all over the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And other days, the plane, you know, the planes are still going overhead, but mm-hmm, there is no track.
Yeah.
Is it? Does it have something to do with the sky itself, or is there more water in the air at that point when they're leaving the tracks, or you know what I mean?
You're hitting it right on the head, Wanda. It has to do with the sky, and particularly has to do with how much water vapor is in the air outside the engine. So the engine's always working on these jet aircraft, and it's spewing out the same amount of water vapor in its own effluent as well as other chemicals. It, depending on what the environment's relative humidity is, and that's a measure of how much water vapor is there, that's going to allow there to either be a cloud in that environment or not. And it's not only that, it's also the temperature. It may also be the level at which the plane is flying, because the level will affect both the temperature and the humidity. So it is those things. It's exactly right. The conditions in the atmosphere at the level of the jet engine makes all the difference in the world.
Thank you. I'm going to tell my husband that.
Yeah. I hope you win the bet.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have Mark in Winnicon. He says, throughout my life, I've heard that the leaves turn color because of the shorter days of fall, not because the weather's cooler. For the past couple of days, however, I've read that the reason the leaves are behind schedule on turning color this year is that the temperatures have been warmer than normal. Aren't these two comments in conflict with each other?
Yeah, I don't know which one is right. And I have a feeling that every year someone's going to suggest it's different this year. Sometimes water stress is definitely a physical factor. You know, if it's been dry in your location, the leaves just may not have what it takes to hang on till the middle of October, regardless of temperature. But I think it is true that the decreasing daylight and decreasing overnight temperatures have some effect on them. I don't know all the details about what's exactly driving the change in the foliage and the actual leafing of the tree when it comes off the tree. That's probably a factor that's controlled by some of those conditions also.
Lee in Green Bay up next. Hi, Lee. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I'll just be real brief about it. And I know nobody wants to talk about it. It's connected with the media or especially the government. But chemtrails, the spraying to control the weather by jets. And I know it's not exhaust, because they were spraying here where I live Friday.
How did you know that?
They were crisscrossing, and a regular exhaust from a jet, certainly whether it's ice particles or whatever, is not going to spread, and it's not going to run from almost one horizon to one horizon. And it's not quite that long, I'm sure.
I know what you mean. They sometimes get kind of long and sort of, you know, like they look like a Tootsie Roll that's been squashed, right?
Yeah, some of them do.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the way the winds are high up above, but you can just see how that stuff is spreading. And a normal exhaust from a jet doesn't do that. And I know they don't want to admit it. People that are connected with the news media, from what I've heard, are forbidden to talk about it. But, I mean, it's happening. They're trying to control the weather. And they've been doing this, I don't know.
Well, let me suggest a couple of things here, Lee. First of all, if anybody's been trying to mount a campaign to control the weather, it's been the most miserable failure of all campaigns ever launched, because we can't control the weather. And if we could, we would never have concerns about droughts, or we would never have concerns about floods or too much snow or whatever it is. So that leads me to conclude that, first of all, that's not likely to be what's going on. And I don't have a horse in this race. I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm trying to be as logical about what I see as I can be. And I find that on certain days, we were just talking about this with another caller you may have heard, we were talking about how jets can leave a trail on some days and not on another one, and that's just because of the conditions in the atmosphere through which they fly. And then in addition to leaving a trail, the trail can be massaged by the winds that are part of the environment, and they can definitely spread it out and make it deeper and so all kinds of different other things. So at a minimum, there are alternative explanations that need to be as thoroughly investigated as any of the investigations that lead a person to believe that there's a conspiracy going on, because I suspect that there is no conspiracy.
It would be pretty difficult to do. But, you know, that's not to say it hasn't been tried.
Well, there was a long period of time in the 50s, right after World War II, where weather control was actually the goal of numerical weather prediction. There was actually a sense that learning how to predict the weather will give us a sense of how to control it. And there were experiments along the lines of cloud seeding and various other that had a long, long history that were not particularly they weren't successful at all. In fact, they were places for various people to run, you know, sort of financial scams on farmers and so on. And it was really a bad deal. And we've exposed that through the scientific method, that this stuff is not reasonable and you can't really conclude anything from it. And so the scientific method is the friend of the farmer in that case. And then sometimes people will say it's the, you know, there's something going on behind all of our backs. It's not really happening.
Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. We had an email question from Dave in Crystal Lake. Is it my imagination? You were talking about wind. That's why I wanted to bring this one up. Or have we had more windy days than usual and higher average winds?
You know, I don't think we have. I suspect it's possible that there's records that certainly there are records that are kept, and you get an hourly wind speed, and then you get a report for the day at a first order station like Madison or Milwaukee. You could certainly do the analysis to see whether or not the winds are stronger. I think we would have heard about that by now, at the surface winds anyway. I know I look at the jet stream a lot, and that's at 300 or so millibars, about 6 miles above the ground, and there's no consistent increase in the wind speeds. There's a different, you know, distribution of them from day to day, but there's no particular increase that doesn't have to do with the seasonal cycle. It gets stronger in the winter time, but then weaker in the summer.
I'm thinking about you guys last night, and this is a little non sequitur in a way, but there were no clouds in the sky last night, which was really, really a good thing, at least
great.
In southern Wisconsin, because we got to see the lunar eclipse.
That was fantastic,
which was just really, really something.
And I was nervous earlier in the day when it was cloudy. You know, I thought, oh, man, what's going to happen tonight? And it just perfectly cleared up for us.
Perfectly clear. Kevin in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Oh, Larry, I just wanted to say, first off, that I'm a delivery driver, and so every single day at 11:30, I have you on the radio, and I love your show. It's very informative and very great.
Thank you.
And my question is, what is the difference between El Niño and El Niño? And I will take my answer off there.
All right.
Yeah, that's a good question. The El Niño is the warming of the central tropical Pacific Ocean all the way to the coast of Peru. That surface water at the equatorial Pacific Ocean gets much warmer than normal. The La Niña is the opposite of that, and that is a situation in which those waters get colder than normal. When the El Niño is in effect, it moves the position of deep tropical thunderstorms from the western Pacific Ocean over Indonesia and the Philippines, that part of the world, moves it to the central part of the Pacific Ocean at about 0 degrees latitude, right at the equator. That changes entirely the structure of jet stream circulations in the northern hemisphere, maybe also in the southern hemisphere, certainly in the northern hemisphere. And the immediate impacts are felt more strongly close to those locations, like over the continent of North America versus over Europe or Africa. For a La Niña, it tends to suppress the activity of convective thunderstorms in the eastern part of the Pacific and shunts it back to more of its normal position over in the western part of the Pacific, and we have conditions that are a little bit more like normal. When we have an El Niño, as we do now, the Midwest tends to have a warmer and less snowy winter. When we have a La Niña, it's about a 50-50 shot. We don't really have a strong signal here with cold eastern Pacific equatorial waters.
And so this year for the winter, as we look at an El Niño, pretty strong one, we can expect a little harsher or no?
No, less.
Just the opposite.
Just the opposite. Yeah. In fact, if you think about the last two winters we've had here in the central part of North America, it's been pretty cold.
Yeah.
We're going to be, and that wasn't even that much colder than normal. Last year wasn't. And we're going to have a warmer than normal winter, it looks like, this coming winter. And that's going to seem like very mild compared to what we've had the last two. So I think the sense that we have of the coming winter after it's over is going to be even heightened compared to what it really was in terms of being mild.
DeLee and Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just had a question myself about what the trees during this time of the year, what is causing, like, what makes some of the trees not be able to keep their leaves as long as the others?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a botanist question. It's a great question because you see the opposite from, I get a 14th floor office here on campus that looks to the south. So I get to see the leaves come out in the spring also. And you can see the different species come out at different times. So it's not all of a sudden everything's green one day. And similarly in the fall, it's not, as you're pointing out, that every single species loses its leaves at the same time either. It must just be something about how they're built and how they compete with each other and for light, water, and various other resources, and that leads to those differences through evolution or something.
To bring this up on Garden Talk sometime and have
it's a good question.
Tree people to do it. I know, like somebody pointed out a maple the other day that had half of the tree is brightly colored, the other half isn't. And I said, okay, so there's some damage there.
That's what it is in a tree near my house. Yeah, it's damage.
Sort or another. That is causing the coloration to start early.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe the death of the tree down the road, or at least that side.
Right.
Yeah. So, but
But between species, it's a good question. They must just have different ways to compete. I mean, I notice in the spring, the first things that come out are the little bushes, because they're going to be out of the competition for sun after about two more weeks. They got to get as much as they can early on, because soon the tall trees are going to shade them out. And so there's all those kinds of competitions that are going on there that you can notice at certain times of
year. Same with like tulips and that, flowers that come up early while there's no leaf canopy.
Yeah, so they have an easy time. They can't do it later.
Yep, an easier time anyway. Email from Dave and Carol. We were kayaking in northern Wisconsin last week, and it got really windy very suddenly. It looked like the wind was blowing downward through the clouds at that point. When we returned to the shore, we noticed that the atmospheric pressure went from 29.32 to 30.08 in about an hour. Is that normal?
That's a very rapid surface pressure change, and it could have been afforded by maybe a local thunderstorm that didn't affect you where you're sitting, but it certainly has a pressure footprint on the ground, and that could have been what it was, and that's going to come along with gusty winds. That's one possible explanation. Another one that I don't think is likely, because we would have noticed it here as well, is these kind of pressure changes can occur in that short amount of time when you have a really rapid development of a cyclone or an anticyclone. But that affects a much wider area, so it wouldn't have been so local. We would have known something about that one.
Joan was wondering, in terms of predicting weather conditions, what information is most useful?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't think there's any single thing you can say is most useful. If I had to, I would say I need to know the temperature structure in three dimensions in the atmosphere. I need to know that, and I need to know the pressure at the surface or some other level above the ground so that I can reconstruct the pressure with the temperature information at a bunch of other levels. Once I know that, I can give you a pretty decent idea of what you could expect in the next 24 hours. I'm not saying me as a person, but our enterprise could do that.
Okay. And we have some other callers online. John, one other question I had was in terms of weather forecasting. We have some pretty good weather people, I think, here in Madison that do a good job on television, for example. Mm-hmm. What kind of training do they get?
Well, quite a large fraction of those people went to school here in our department at the University of Wisconsin, and I know quite a number of them, and so I feel a little bit uncomfortable telling you what kind of training they should get, but they should get training that involves me and Steve and all my colleagues, and many of them did. And, to be 100% serious, although that's part of the seriousness, is they are scientists. They've been trained as physical scientists, so they have a great broad background in mathematics, they have a broad background in pure physics, and then they apply both of those tools to analyzing the atmosphere as a physical system. And so that's the skill that they bring right out of undergraduate school, and then they go into the shop at one of the broadcasting companies and they learn a little bit more about how to actually make a forecast in a short amount of time. That's where they first feel the time pressure on the forecasting side of things. And then, of course, the professional delivery, which is no small deal. I mean, to do that well and to inform the public about important things is not easy, and they have to get trained at that. We don't have a hand in that, except insofar as part of their classroom stuff is public presentations.
I've had people who have visited town say, boy, you have some good weather people here.
Yeah, we do. We do. I'm very proud of them. Even the ones that I don't know, I'm very proud of them, because they take their job seriously, and it's one that is held in very high regard by people who live in a weather-conscious part of the world.
Emmanuel in Kenosha, thanks for calling. Do you have a quick question?
Thanks for taking my call. I actually had a quick clarification on a previous caller's question regarding the National Weather Service radar. There are actually not two types of radar. The base and composite are simply two different types of product coming from the same radar, and they simply refer to the intensity and the angle of tilt that the antenna is used at when creating these images. Namely, the base image will be the lowest angle of tilt relative to the horizon at its lowest intensity, and the composite will be the highest intensity echoes from any tilt of the antenna that's used for sampling that particular span of the atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's a good distinction. So I couldn't tell based on the question, because it was only in words, whether it was a regional question or it was just looking at the Green Bay radar, for instance. There's two different ways that are described on their webpage. That's a very good point.
Very, very good. Thank you so much for calling in and making that clarification. I appreciate it very much. And John, boy, it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's fun.
Hopefully Steve will be done with his cold.
I hope so. Hope he's done by tomorrow.
But the last Monday of the month rolls around pretty quick,
it seems like. Yeah, it sure does.
About every 30 days or so.
That seems to be what it is.
John Martin, our guest today, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And he and Steve, you generally come by the last Monday of the month, of every month, and talk with us about weather and climate. And they'll be doing it again in the month of October. They'll be here right before Halloween. And thank you for listening. Tomorrow we'll talk about some delicious apple recipes. And then, keeping a food theme, we'll talk about atypical squash varieties in your cooking. In the meantime, thank you so much again for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.